Jazz Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the Jazz Podcast. I am your host, Rob Cope, and with me tonight is Dan Farrant.
Good. Well, is it tonight? Or people might be listening to this during the day, Rob.
Oh, yeah. Shall I not generalise about the time?
Well, I mean, we're recording it in the evening, but yeah. I don't know. You have to say hello to them as if they're maybe listening it.
All right.
At a nondescript time.
Hello, nondescript listeners at a nondescript time. Oh, so I told you to find out about us people. Well, I tell you one person that has, Nikki Iles.
Nikki Iles has got back to
us. Yes, if you watched the trailer last month, you'll have noticed we threw Nikki's name in there, having never actually really gotten her permission to do it.
Yeah.
So she's listened to the show and is totally up for being on it.
Is that part of our news?
Oh, yeah. This is a big part of
You haven't done your intro set, you know. Yeah.
I'll edit this in prior. Ba 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 ba. So Nikki's in touch. If you follow her example, people, find out about us. Be like Nikki and find out about the show if you're not already listening. That's how it's done.
Yeah. That's a good way to get people to listen, is to tell them once they're listening to listen.
Yeah, exactly. This is not for you who are listening. This is for those of you that are not aware of our podcast.
I guess we could ask the current listeners to leave us a review or to share it with someone.
Oh, classy. Yes. A review on iTunes goes a long way. Alex Monk is in the news this week.
Oh, can you say Monk again? That came out really nicely.
Monk. Alex Monk. Alex Monk. I can't stop doing it now. The news is that they're playing next Tuesday, the 14th of Feb, at the Spotted Dog in Birmingham.
Mm.
And obviously, Birmingham's quite a useful place to have a gig because it's kind of easy. I don't want to say easy to get to, but it's pretty accessible. Like, if you lived in North London, I live in Southwest London. If you lived in the North, it's quicker to get up to Birmingham to watch Alex's gig than if he came to come down, play down here.
That's true.
Yeah.
So, Alex Monk's band, they're playing, are they?
Yeah.
Did he ask you to do a shout-out for this?
No.
Cool.
I just decided that...
That's nice of you.
Yeah, well, you know, we're a very philanthropic podcast.
I had listened to Trish's album, My Iris,
after
we spoke to her. I really enjoyed that.
Oh, beautiful.
Did you listen to it, Rob?
No, I will. Okay. I'm just full of hot air sometimes. This is one of those times.
That's a nice little pun there with the flying machine there.
Ah, yes.
Right. Very good.
That was not intentional. His band, Matt Robinson, Connor Chaplin, Dave Hamlet, Alex Monk. You can't go wrong. Mm. Something else I noticed, David Bowden has won the Scottish Young Jazz Musician of the Year competition.
Oh, great.
Yeah, bassist. So I think you'd appreciate that.
Check him out.
I've tried desperately to win this award year after year, but my lack of being from Scotland is holding me back seriously. Right, let's do some kind of ending. Do 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 do.
We've got Femi coming on now. I missed this recording, so I actually haven't listened to it, Rob.
Oh man, well here it comes. I'm about
I'll have a listen to it.
Sweet. Oh, right. That's one more listener for the show. That's good news.
But I'll have to listen to it when it comes out. That'll be nice.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to go.
For the first time. That'll be nice. Right. Shall we hit play then?
Let's do it. Here he comes.
Femi Tomorrow.
Growing up, you grew up in Nigeria?
Yes, for a little bit, short while.
Right.
Till I was about 10.
Right. How was it?
It was hot. No, I'm joking. it was that as well, but it was an interesting childhood because, to be honest, I feel like it was, I don't know, ever since I was probably about 5 or 6, you know, there's this thing called Wanderlust that people talk about now. It's like quite hip to talk about Wanderlust. I think I had it when I was about 5 years old.
What is it?
It's, you know, basically wanting to travel. You know, it's like wanting to basically, yeah.
I'm sure that's like a Radiohead song.
Possibly.
That's like the only time I've ever seen that word before.
It's possible. Is it German? Wanderlust? Something like, anyway, it sounds, it looks German when you see it. But, you know, like, to lust after wandering, one would think, right? Anyway, so I think I had it from a very young age. And so I always felt like there was something else out there, you know, for me. And when my father came one day and picked me up and said, oh, we're going to London.
Yeah.
That must have been the one single kind of happiest day of my life, I think.
Did you always know he was going to come and
do
that?
No, not at all. Because I knew that he lived in London with the rest of my family, but I didn't. But I was living with my grandmother, so I didn't know that was going to happen until the day it did. I think the whole process took about a week, and it was, I don't know, a 10-year-old me just was really anxious for 1 week, thinking, oh, it may not happen, I might get sent back to live with. And it wasn't because I wasn't happy living in Nigeria. It was just because I knew that there was something else out there, you know, and I really wanted to know what it was and take part, you know. And I've kind of had that ever since, really, to be honest.
Yeah. You know. So you're still itching to travel now?
All the time. As soon as I get, you know, when I'm away, I'm like, oh, it'd be nice to go home.
Yeah.
As soon as I get back, I'm like, oh, yeah, it'd be nice to go away somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, always itching to travel. I think partly because I really love people and stories. And you, of course, you can meet people and hear stories wherever you are, especially living somewhere like London, where you meet people from all over the world. But there's nothing like people in their own habitat, in their own territory, you know, and kind of trying to get to know and understand their perspective of life, where they are from. There's nothing like that, you know. So that's one of the things.
You started playing guitar when you were
17. Is that right? Yeah, thereabouts.
And then how did you get into it in the first place?
Church.
Yeah.
Grew up grew up in church, first of all. But then in my mid-teens, I was a little bit badly behaved. Just a little bit. Not hugely. But enough for my mum to say, oh, in order for me to keep an eye on you on a weekend, you're going to come with me to choir rehearsals.
Yeah.
So I would get dragged along, kicking and screaming. And then after about 6 months of that, I was allowed to play the claves, which is the two sticks that you beat together.
Right.
But when I was learning to play that, I remember the choir master at the time saying to me, look, these are the two most important instruments in the whole thing.
Yeah.
This keeps everybody together. Yeah. So you are the most important person. And I don't know, just that process gave me a feeling of being significant.
Yeah.
And it, in a way, it helped with my behavior because I was like, wow, I actually mean something to these people, you know, belong somewhere. And then maybe a few months after that, I graduated to playing some hand drums. And then there were these two other young guys in the choir at the time who played instruments. One played bass, the other played guitar and drums. Actually, funny enough, I didn't know at the time that we were actually related.
Really?
We didn't know we were related. Yeah, it's funny. I'm related on my mum's side.
Right. Did she know?
I think so, but I don't know. It was weird. The way we found out was we ended up at a kid's party. Well, kid's party, you know.
Yeah,
young people's party. And then they asked for the family on one side to come together. And then I saw my mum and their mum. I'm like, why are you guys in the same? And then they were like, oh, yeah, because, you know, so-and-so is so-and-so's cousin. And they're like, really? So then, you know, but then funny enough, these two guys, one of them is a bass player that a lot of people might know. His name is Michael Olatuja. Lives in New York now. And he taught me how to play guitar. So he was like, oh, do you want to learn some guitar? Because he was playing bass in a choir at the time. He was only, what, 12 or something, but he was already really good.
And how old are you at this point?
about 17, about 5 years older, something like that.
Yeah, of course.
So he was like, "Do you want to?" And I'm like, "Who's this like this 12-year-old kid wants to show me how to play?" But I was interested enough to, you know, be humble and go, "Okay, cool, whatever, yeah." And he showed me some chords, and then his brother, his older brother, who's a bit closer to my age, showed me a few more things, and I just kind of got hooked on it. And actually, what it was the fact that the better you got, the more you felt you belonged to the choir, because you felt like you were useful, you know. Yeah. People needed you, you know, and that was a really good feeling. And I think that's what kept me going initially. But then, of course, as I could see that I was getting better at it, it made me want to learn more, and you know, and then you kind of get into it, and then it turned around where at first my mom was happy I was doing it, to the point where it started to interfere with my studying of the, you know, traditional subjects that they wanted everyone to do. And she was like, this is not a good idea, and she would hide the guitar from time to time. But then I would find it, you know, the one at home. I would find it and play it, and I would get told off for not doing my homework and but in the end I won, you know. I just kind of went behind her back. Someone gave me a prospectus for Leeds College of Music,
right?
Funny enough, I was about 20 at this point. And I went behind her back, applied for an audition. Didn't know how I would get to Leeds because I wasn't working. I didn't have any money of my own.
You were living in South London.
In Streatham.
Yeah.
Or St. Reetham, as we used to call it back then. Pretending it was it is posh now, but back then it wasn't. I got up this prospectus, applied, got an audition, and then I couldn't bring myself to tell my mum, so I told my uncle, knowing he would tell her. Actually, I told him, asking him if he would like buy me a train ticket to get out there. But I knew he would go and tell her, so he told her. She had a fit, but she was like, "Okay, well, you've done it now. Here's 50 quid.
Yeah,
get your train ticket, get something to eat, and you know." And I had to stay over, so you know, stayed in a really cheap B&B, which back then that was what, 96? Whoa. Oh, a lot of time has passed, right? Yeah, back in, I think, 96, I went up there and auditioned and got in. And that was that.
Yeah.
You know, got hooked.
That's really something after 3 years of, like...
Yeah, playing every day. Yeah. Well, I was playing in church 3 days a week.
Looking for your guitar every day.
Yeah, just to play it. Yeah, exactly. It was, I mean, I remember in the early days, I was just so hooked. I just thought... There was no point doing anything else.
Yeah. How are you learning at this point then?
Just from cassette tapes. Right. So there was an older guy in the choir who was into guitar, and he was into a bit of jazz guitar actually. And I remember he gave me a tape. One side was Wes Montgomery, the other side was George Benson. And he said, "Go home and listen to this, and next week I want you to tell me which side you prefer." I guess he was trying to gauge me somehow. And I came back, of course I was excited about the Benson side because it was really flash and he played really fast and everything was fiery. And I came back and said, "Oh, I love, you know, side B," or whatever it was. And he said, "Yeah, but side A has more melody on it." So, like, "What do you mean, what's melody? Like, I don't care about melody, you know. It just sounds amazing, you know." And he, you know, and he would sometimes after church, he'd stay behind, show me a few things, you know. I remember him trying to teach me the blues pentatonic scale, and I was like, "What is this?" You know, like, I wanted to learn the major scale because that's what we played in church all the time. Yeah. I was more fascinated by that, funny enough, than the blues pentatonic scale. So I was kind of just learning off tapes and, you know, whatever he had time to show me, whenever he had time to show me stuff. And then a few years in, also there was another guy who's also a Nigerian guitar player who I used to go to his house every Wednesday. And at the time he was working two jobs. So he would go to his first job in the morning, he would come home at 5 p.m. and I would be waiting at his door 5 to 5 every Wednesday without fail. And basically what would happen was he would get home, be like, "Hey, how you doing?" Open the door. We'll go into this flat where there's four of them live. They all share this apartment in on the old Kent Road. Go in. He would literally practice for like an hour or an hour and a half before going to his second job in the evening. And all I did was sit there and watch him practice and occasionally say, "Stop, what was that?" you know, sometimes I wouldn't even bring my guitar out the case. I'll just literally watch him practice for an hour and a half. This went on for about, I don't know, maybe 9 months to a year. And then I would go from there to the evening service at church on a Wednesday and try to remember stuff that I learned to try to play it, you know. It's funny. It's funny because I forgot that that happened until recently when someone was asking me. Someone said, "Oh, I met this guy called Kunle, who's the guitarist, and he said he used to teach you." And I was like, "Goodness me, yeah, I used to go to his house every Wednesday for a long time to just sit and listen." So that was my kind of way of learning in the early days until I got to Leeds.
So was Leeds a massive culture shock?
It was the biggest culture shock ever.
Yeah.
Because you know, up until this point, I was what 20 now, 20 years old, 20. And to be honest with you, I'd been so kind of soaked and immersed in a kind of a Nigerian community while I was even living here I'd been living here 10 years up until that point, that I still didn't even really understand British culture or humour mostly. When I got to Leeds, like, I remember the first time people asked me around to go to a pub. I'd never been in a pub before, you know. And I remember my flatmates all went to this pub and they all sat around in the table. People were like making these jokes and laughing. I could not for the life of me find why it was funny. I was like, why is that funny? You know, that's not funny. But it was the time that I spent there that really educated me about, you know, British culture, British humour. I'd never tasted a curry before that. I remember the first curry I had didn't go down too well. So it was also my last curry for a while because I thought it's got to be about the curry,
like,
right?
Like trying smoking or something.
Exactly. Like, yeah. Like, curry, you know, hard drugs, you know. It was a huge culture shock. I mean, it was definitely a big shock musically. Because I thought I was really good on guitar at that point. And then I remember my first couple of days, I saw these two guys jamming in the corridors. One sounded like Pat Metheny and the other one sounded like Joel Pass or someone, you know. And I was like, whoa. And I was like, how old are you guys? He was like, oh, I'm 19. I was like, get out of here, you know. And I was so like, I just felt so insecure about everything, not just music, but just as well, just like as a person, I felt like I hadn't seen anything, I didn't know anything. I was so sheltered that I just became a sponge from there on, you know. I would just go to every gig and every rehearsal that was open and just sit in and listen to people talk and, you know, try to become part of what was going on.
Yeah.
It was a huge shock for me. Yeah. So it was the fact that I didn't have anyone around who in any way resembled the people I was used to, like culturally or, you know, even like emotionally or spiritually. There was nobody like that. So it was like starting from scratch, you know. But it really helped me to find another side of myself that I didn't know at all.
Yeah.
You know, which is why, one of the reasons why I think traveling is so good for you, you know, to meet people very unlike you,
you
know, whether they're, you know, 2 hours up the road on a train or 18 hours away on a plane.
Yeah.
You know, it's really good for you, you know.
And after Leeds, you went to Middlesex.
Yes.
Did you go straight away?
No, I didn't. When I finished my access course in Leeds, I applied for the degree.
Yeah.
And I didn't get in. Not because I wasn't good enough to get in, but because by the time, and it happened to a lot of the guys who were in my year of the access course, there was a lot of like drama going on with Leeds College at that time. There was a lot of issues with money. And I remember there was this bass player, I'm trying to remember his name now, and he was kind of spearheading this movement to try to force the college to be more transparent about what was going on, because there was a lot of rumors about how it was going to close down, because money was being squandered or it's going missing. I remember there was one protest outside the school where an effigy was made of whoever was the head of the school at the time. Burnt, mind you. And a lot of us who were on that year on that access course, we didn't get onto the degree because we were left till last to be auditioned. And you know, you pay for auditions.
Yeah.
And they had already filled up all the spaces. So basically, as people auditioned and met the grade, they were they were you know, they were taken on.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like an appropriate system.
No, you would think you would wait until you've auditioned everyone.
Yeah, and then
whoa, that's what I thought, you know. And, but apparently they were auditioning people and enrolling people who they thought were good enough, but they carried on. It's kind of like the airplanes do, right? Yeah. Where they overbook, right? Yeah. They take your money anyway and they put you on standby. That's what was going on.
Yeah.
So a lot of us didn't get on, and we didn't know until it got leaked. It was kind of like some, you know, some. There was a lot of stuff going on at the time.
Yeah.
And it got leaked and we all found out and we weren't happy. And there was a big hoorah about it. Anyway, I got angry, thought, right, I'm going back to London, and came back to London. I had to take a year out because by that time, it was too late to audition for any of the other colleges in London. So I took a year out and went and basically spent the year at Richmond College. I spent the year going to Richmond. I went because my cousin, Michael Olatuja, he was at Richmond College at the time. And he said, oh, just come with me to college. And I'm sure they won't mind you just like popping your head in. And I was like, I'm sure they'll mind. You know, there are other people paying to be there. He was like, well, come for one day and meet Paul. So there was this guy called Paul Jenkins, who's a trumpet player, who was running the performing arts course there at the time. So I went along one day and just had a jam with some of the students. And Paul was really into it. He was like, look, just don't tell anyone. Just come in and, you know, just vibe every day. Like, all right. So I said to my mum, I'm not taking her out. I've enrolled at Richmond College. Wink, wink. Yeah. She was like, okay. So every morning I would go to college, you know, and I did that for a year, you know. And while I was there, I met this incredible...
Sorry, if I missed something.
Yeah.
Have you actually enrolled or are you just showing up?
I was just showing up every day.
Right.
Yeah. So I didn't...
But did no one ever say to you, like, you're not on this register or...
No, because I was in tight with the head of the course. So he knew that I was there.
Ah, cool.
So Paul Jenkins, he was the head of... So he knew I was there, but the college didn't know I was there.
Right.
Hopefully they won't listen to this podcast.
Yeah.
So I basically went for three terms and just jammed every day.
Right.
With all the other students there. Met some really great people there at the college at the time. Of course, my cousin was going there, and then I met another guitarist who's a great guitar player and producer now. His name's Joe Caleb.
Right.
He was there at the time. And they were all a bit younger than me, but it didn't matter. And I spent my year out that way, basically, and then reapplied for Leeds.
Yeah.
And me and Michael reapplied for Leeds together. We got in.
Yeah.
We went up there.
Yeah.
We started.
Yeah.
We were there for 2 weeks, and one day we went to a gig where Steve Berry was playing.
Right.
I was talking about him earlier. And I remember after the gig, Steve came to me and Michael and says, if you two have any sense... you would go back to London tomorrow. We were like, why? He was like, because I don't know if this college is going to be here in 3 months. There's a lot going on. So we got really scared. We were like, oh. So Michael, and he says, look, I know someone at Middlesex. I'll ring him up and tell him that you're going to call. So he gave us Stuart Hall's number. He was the head of the course at Middlesex at the time. So we rang, and of course, a lot of schools always have a lack of bass players. So Michael rang Stuart Hall. He was like, yeah, sure. If Steve Berry's recommending you, then come on down. You know, start on Monday.
Yeah.
And Michael says, well, but what about my cousin? He plays guitar. He's like, oh, we've got too many guitarists already. Michael's like, well, if you don't take him, I won't come.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, go on then. So that was how we both got into Middlesex. And so we ended up in Middlesex. And then Joe, Caleb, the other guitar player, he was at, what's the other place? Not the Academy, Guildhall. He was at Guildhall, and you know their course is 4 years, and the first year is like mandatory classical thing you
gotta
do.
A 50-50 split.
And he absolutely hated it. I mean, he loved classical music, he just didn't like the approach.
Yeah.
So he left there and came running to Middlesex. So we were like the three musketeers were complete again.
Yeah.
So we spent, you know, our 3 years at Middlesex under the tutelage of Stuart Hall, Chris Batchelor, Eddie Parker, some great musicians. I loved Middlesex because they really gave you the room to really, really experiment.
Yeah.
I didn't feel that it was as strict as, say, the Academy or even Guildhall. You know, we were based on this amazing campus, which was basically on a golf course.
Yeah.
And everyone on the course was some sort of hippie.
Yeah.
You know, it basically, at the time, I think people used to see Middlesex as kind of the reject kind of center of all the other academies and conservatoires. But actually, it was just the people who wanted to study jazz but have a little bit of leeway to kind of deal with some other things.
Yeah.
And it was great for that, I think. I really enjoyed my time there. And being around people like Stuart Hall was just inspiring every day, because I mean, people don't talk about him, but he is an incredible, incredible musician. Plays probably about six instruments to an incredible standard, you know, double bass, guitar, violin, piano, amongst other things. And he was just so humble and really giving, you know. And it was nice to be around people like that for 3 years and all the other students. And we just kind of stayed there all day, every day, and played, you know. It was almost like once you got onto that campus, the outside world didn't exist, you know, in a funny way, but in a good way.
Yeah.
So Middlesex was great.
Oh, amazing.
It's a good experience.
Yeah.
You know?
I think it's never something to be underestimated with education, you know, with the, like, you want the individual personality.
Yes.
Of whoever it is that's playing to be like at the forefront.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
No one wants to listen to someone who just sounds exactly like someone else.
Exactly.
You know, that's not a road.
Yeah. And that's what, and I think that's one of the great things about Middlesex was, you know, the way, even the way that the classes were taught at the time, maybe a part of me thought that the teaching was a little bit lazy, but I realized that actually they were trying to get you to discover rather than to just hand you information, you know, which is a trick that I use a lot now myself with a lot of my students.
Funny you say that, because I find if you go to have a lesson, a jazz lesson with someone over like roughly the age of about 60, they really won't tell you anything.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll give you life lessons.
Of course.
You'll sit and have a play, you can listen to records.
Absolutely.
But you never get into the, like, what scale can I use?
Exactly.
Over this chord, you know?
Absolutely. That, And, you know, I have students who ask me that now, and I'm like, sometimes I'll just say, I don't know.
Yeah.
Not because I don't know, but because, first of all, their reaction to that reply tells me a lot about them.
Yeah.
And how they're going to proceed going forward.
Yeah.
Because if their reaction is like, oh, like really kind of disappointed that I don't know, then I know that, oh, you're not really the kind of person who's going to dig and search.
Yeah.
But if they're like, oh, okay, and then they ask other questions to try to get there. Or they'll say, okay, well, let's play. I've had a couple of students who go, well, let's just play, and every time you do something, I'll stop you. You know, and then and I'm like, okay, see, that's the kind of person who really wants to know. They're going to dig in any case. And after a while, you may say to them, well, yeah, I'm doing this. And they'll be like, yeah, but I thought you said you did. I was like, I just wanted to see your reaction, you know. Or I'll be like, well, that's not important right now.
Yeah.
What's important is that you understand, you know, how to play just the head of this song properly.
Yeah.
Or understand how the chords work or whatever. You know, anything that keeps you away from that dreaded, what scale do I play for a dominant chord? You know, it's like, who cares?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I wasn't taught by people who thought like that.
Yeah.
And so I've never really thought like that. And I've even had students who think that I must not be very good if I don't, you know, if I don't think like that way. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, that's your opinion and it's fine. It's entirely yours and you're entitled to it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But yeah, I think for sure, you know, any music, it's got to be about the personality of the person playing. Because at the end of the day, as the guy who I used to go to his house every Wednesday night, remember he used to say to me, look, Femi, eventually everybody will be able to play fast. And everybody will learn all the skills there are to learn. But not everybody will play music, you know. And that was the thing that stuck with me forever and ever and ever.
He used to
drum that into me every week.
Yeah.
Because he would do fast licks. I'd be like, oh, what's that fast lick? Show me that. He'd be like, no. It's not about the fast lick, you know. It's can you hear the music inside it? Because if you can't, there's no point playing it.
Yeah.
You know, that's what he used to say to me. You know, be like, okay. You know, and try to learn from that perspective. You know, and also try to teach from that perspective now, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you, after Middlesex, you got on a couple of pop tours.
Oh. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they kind of started just at the end of my time at Middlesex.
Do you have a standout one?
so far looking back that you really enjoyed, or an artist that you particularly enjoyed, you know, to be working with?
Probably Amy Winehouse.
Yeah.
And also this other singer called Terry Walker, who probably a lot less, well, not probably, is a lot less known, but yeah. I really enjoyed playing with her because that tour was basically full of a bunch of jazz musicians who were kind of playing the other side of themselves, you know.
Yeah.
But in a way that was, I found it a lot more enjoyable than playing the pop tours with the pop guys, in a way, you know, because it just didn't feel as limiting and as limited. I used to be on certain pop gigs and I'll be practicing like in the dressing room, and someone would come, why are you practicing? Like, what is that? What are you doing there?
Wow.
Yeah, like, don't you already know how to play? I'd be like...
you know the three chords, man. What are you doing?
I'd be like, yeah, but that's not all there is to life. You know that, right? But yeah, I mean, not a lot of people, but there are some people who thought that way. And I hated being around people like that because they just made you feel small. And it made you feel limited.
Yeah.
For me, the whole point of music was also always to try to get to a point where you felt like you could go anywhere you want, however you wanted, without feeling, even though the limitations would be there, you didn't want to be confronted with them, you know, day in, day out, necessarily. I heard the scones in here are good, by the way.
Okay. Cool.
Anyway. So, yeah, I would say Amy's gig because, of course, that... I was the music director in that band, and that gave me a lot of street cred, if you like.
Yeah, totally.
And it gave me a lot of freedom with the music, to arrange the music, how I saw fit based on what she wanted also. And it was fun. Again, you know, there were a few musicians on there who also come from a jazz background, who it was nice to play with them in that scenario because they understood... you know, certain things that I wanted to do with the music.
Yeah.
You know, and they could take it there.
Yeah.
The Terry Walker gig was great. It was a huge band. It was like 13 or 14 people. Yeah. Two guitarists. It was me and this guy called Dave Okuma, who's an amazing musician and producer. Jason Yard was one of the MDs. His brother, James Yard, was the MD. Jason was the other MD. He also did a lot of the horn arrangements in that band. A trumpet player called Sean Corby from up north. He was in that band. A lot of great guys in that band. It's a good experience. A couple of other things that I did along the way. I mean, I really enjoyed it. Funny enough, I enjoyed playing with Samantha Mumba.
I was just thinking about her.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it because a lot of the gigs we did was just duo.
Yeah.
So I was just playing guitar and she was singing. And you know, it wasn't like...
That seems quite rare for a pop.
Yeah, I mean, well, it was then, but I think it was at a point where labels were realizing the power of being able to do that.
Yeah.
In terms of it got the artists playing a lot more gigs than just kind of wait until you could book the whole band for stuff. And I think for artists like her, it was necessary because it gave them an experience that they'd never had, you know. For her, it put her in a very uncomfortable space.
Yeah.
Cause she wasn't used to being, if you like, for her voice to be that exposed.
Yeah.
And I could see that she really wanted to work at it, but I think, you know, the A&R and some of the management weren't very... They never wanted the artist to sound bad. Yeah. What they didn't understand is before you can sound good, you have to sound bad.
Yeah.
And a lot of these artists never went through that thing of 3 years in music college or, you know, slogging it at jam sessions all around the city and really getting their craft together.
Yeah.
They got signed sometimes just off the strength of how they looked and they could sing a bit.
Yeah.
And that was it. And so they didn't have this kind of, you know, the woodshed years.
Yeah, I mean, I got a lot of recordings of myself that I'm really glad that no one ever heard.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, the woodshed years. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was good for her, and I think she was enjoying the challenge, but they weren't enjoying the fact that people were saying, oh, you know, she sounded flat there and blah, blah, blah. They just wanted her to sound good straight away.
Yeah.
That was never going to happen. Yeah. You know, you just can't, you can't bypass that. And they basically pulled the plug on a lot of those gigs. And then sooner or later, I think those gigs just nosedive. They don't go anywhere because the artists don't grow. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? They don't grow.
Yeah. Like you say, there's no, when you can't have the Woodshed years, you can't really expect the musical growth.
Exactly.
You know, and that's going to get stagnant.
They only want financial growth.
Yeah.
They don't want musical growth. No. No. Because they can always just, once that artist is done, they'll just pick the next one up.
Yeah.
There's always, there's a, you know, there's an entire continent full of people waiting to be picked up.
Yeah.
By labels.
Yeah.
And put through the 3-year mill. You know, they might do something, they might not. Doesn't matter. You know, it's just, they keep turning it around. Some never see the light of day. You know, I remember rehearsing with artists who, we would rehearse for 2 weeks, but then that's it. They'll never do a gig, they'll never go on the road.
Yeah.
You know, they would just be written off as a tax, a loss.
Wow.
You know,
yeah.
And that would be that. So, yeah. But it was good to, it was, those years were good for me because I got to learn another side of music. You know?
Yeah, it's a really,
I think it's important.
Contrasting
situation,
a pop industry.
Absolutely.
It's yeah. So different, it's so financially driven.
Oh, man. There were a lot of, I must say, there were a lot of positives to be had. You know, there was, I learned a lot about, you know, like framing music.
Yeah.
You know, like setting music so that, you know, you didn't have necessarily the freedom that you have on a gig playing standards, for instance.
Yeah.
So you had to frame the music in a way so that it worked and could work every night for 3 months.
Yeah.
Going around different places.
Yeah.
So that was definitely one of the things I learned from doing it. I also learned that, you know, being able to play one scale and a few chords, but being able to really arrest people's attention with the smallest amount of music possible was also as important as being able to understand, you know, sonata form and, do you know what I mean? And listen to symphonies without getting lost. Do you know what I mean? Not that I can up to this point, but, you know, it was just as important for different reasons. But you just had to, you had to be dedicated to it, and you had to really, you know, rather than do it exclusively, for me it was just, I wanted to know about all of it.
Yeah.
You know, what makes a successful pop musician successful? What makes a successful jazz musician successful? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to learn about all of it and be confident and comfortable about being around people from all the different backgrounds, you know, in the same way that I like to meet people from different backgrounds.
Yeah.
You know, those were the positives for me, I think. A lot of negatives, the fact that the bottom line, the financial bottom line was king.
Yeah.
That didn't help anyone, really.
Yeah.
Least of all, the music, a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But
that's what fascinates me about it, that musically, obviously for me, coming from a jazz background, a situation in which the music's not the thing that you're worrying about.
Right.
But that's the product.
Yeah.
You know, that's
I know, it's
really
crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's quite bizarre.
Yeah.
It's like when I was a kid, I used to watch the Two Ronnies.
Yeah.
And they had a segment they used to do called The Worm That Turned. I don't know if you ever heard of that.
Yeah.
Of course, it's a saying, right? The worm has turned. And in this world where the worm had turned, it was mostly to do with gender roles, you know, so all the things that women traditionally did, blah, 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 was all swapped around. And I felt when I first got into the pop world, it felt like that. It felt like everything was on upside down, you know, like priorities were completely reversed, you know, and it bugged me for a long time. But then I remember there was a guy called Lawrence Johnson who, it was an agent that I worked with for a long time. And he was the one, he said to me, look, in this world, it's important that you're really, really good. But it's also important, like as a musician, but it's also important that people don't think that you're too good, because then they become intimidated. And then you become a threat. And then maybe you won't get the work.
Yeah.
And I was like, really?
Yeah.
You know, he's like, he said, you've got to find a way to be really good and put good ideas into the pot without ever intimidating anyone.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of do your bit, do it good, do it well, and step out.
Yeah.
And if you want to keep working, that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
And it worked. You know, you never, you know, you didn't want to be that kid in class who raised his hand fastest every time the teacher asked a question. But, you know, you'd put in your little bit and then you step away and it's like, oh, this is how it's done. Whereas, you know, it's like whenever I hung out with jazz musicians again, it's like, right, let's play this tune. Right there, let's go. Yeah, who can play? You know, who's going to chop the changes the best and who's going to, you know, it's like it's a completely different world. But I think both are valid and, you know, there's a time and a place. That's all. Like, that's what I learned. There's a time and a place.
Did you ever play a guitar solo so special that you knew for a fact that a crowd surf was on the cards?
Not in pop and not in jazz. It's never happened to me.
Okay.
Because I feel like, I don't know. It's weird, isn't it? I mean, of course, I've had moments where I'm like, oh, that was good. But then you listen back to it, you're like, oh, actually, it wasn't that good, was it? You were just kind of, you know, I don't know, riding on the wave of the moment. You know, everybody was feeling happy, so you felt like you were playing a really good solo.
Yeah. But
I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe it happened and I just didn't, you know.
You were busy trying not to be too good.
Exactly. I was like, oh, I better play it down.
Play it cool. And
yeah.
I
remember taking a solo. I remember playing with Amy at the 50th anniversary of Fender Guitars at Wembley Arena.
And they gave you a guitar for that gig.
They did give me a guitar for that gig. It was an amazing blue Fender. Yeah, yeah, I kept it.
Wow.
Yeah, it's at home now.
Is
yeah.
Is this the best one that you've got?
No, it's not. But only because I don't play it every day.
Right.
A guitarist's best guitar is the one he plays every day, even if it's not technically the best built instrument.
Right.
It's a little life insight
that's
there.
Nice.
And it was great because, so I got this solo, right? In this gig, and I felt like it was a decent solo. It was all right, but I was like really bricking it because, you know, like everybody was there. Like when I say everybody, like Brian May was there. What's his face? Gary Moore was there from Thin Lizzy. Eric Clapton was there, even though he didn't play on that day. He was there. And they were all on the side of the stage when we were playing.
Oh, nice.
I was breaking it. You know? And the funny thing was, I was like, yeah, but I come from jazz stock.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter that, you know, it's these guys just play blues, you know. No. But meeting them, there was just some gravitas that they had.
Yeah.
You know, there was an air about them that was just...
Definitely, especially Clapton.
Yeah,
he's
you just
not
couldn't...
even play it.
That's what I'm saying.
No.
You couldn't put your finger on what it was, but you knew that these guys... Because they were part of something. You know, they were part... You know, that was the thing. They were doing it when nobody else was doing it.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I mean? Not nobody else in the world. But, you know, like guys like Clapton, he was already playing guitar... What, 20 years before I was even born or something? I don't know, maybe not 20, maybe 15 years.
Yeah.
But it's like you can't, there's something about that you can't get away from, no matter what it, you know.
Yeah.
What, no matter how good you thought you were or whatever. But, you know, they were all there. And there were a few others. I can't remember some of the names now. You know, what's the guitarist from, not Led Zepp, the other band? There's two bands. There's Led Zeppelin
right
and there's...
Was that Pink Floyd?
Pink Floyd. There you go. Yeah. Who's the guitarist from Pink Floyd again? I forget his name. You guys don't know. Yes. Let's Google it. Let's Google it.
Go on Google here.
While you're Googling it. So he was there. And I remember he played this like really long tune with Pino Palladino on bass and someone else on the drums. I can't remember the name of the drummer. Oh, the drummer was... he's from the jazz community. He used to play a lot with what's his name again? I used to go and see them play at 606 a lot. Who's the bass player who plays electric bass from the Canada Jacko school, British guy, and he's got a big band.
Lawrence Cottle.
Who's the drummer who plays a lot with Lawrence Cottle? It's like 20 questions here.
Oh, man.
He used to play all the time. They used to play all the time at the 606 club. I used to go see them all the time.
people are going to be yelling at their iPhones.
Yeah, they're going to be like, how can you not know?
The alleged
you call yourself jazz musicians.
Drummers, how old would this guy? Like, similar
probably like, no. Probably like 50s now, mid-50s, I'd say.
Like, who could there be?
However old Lawrence is, then probably that age group.
I'm scared to guess in case I name someone that's like a bassist as well or something.
We'll get it. We've got our Googles out, right? Yeah, Google that. So Pink Floyd guitarist is...
What's all this stuff?
This is terrible.
Who's up there?
Yes, Gilmour.
Dave Gilmour. I'm just going to edit in me saying, it's Dave Gilmour.
So he was there. So there's all these like amazing, great guitar players. And I'm there. And me and Amy are there, you know, we're like sat in our dressing room.
Yeah.
We're like, and she's like, oh, fam, do you think we should play today? Because like, there's all these like amazing musicians here. Like, maybe we should just like knock it on the head. I was like, Amy, we're going to go out there. We're going to be great. Okay, we're going to do this. And we were playing. So it was me and her. We were playing with a house band. We went up. We did the big single at the time was this tune, Stronger Than Me. And we did that. We did a duo tune. We did that. And after the gig, like, we had all these people, like, you two sounded really, like, are you guys a band? They didn't know who she was at the time. Like, right. Are you guys a band? You know, like, no, I was like, I'm just a guitar player. She's the, you know, and they really loved it, you know, and it was such a great feeling, like, getting, you know, a pat on the back from some of these guys, you know, that for me, it was, in some ways, it was even more valuable than if someone like George Benson had come and said to me, oh, you know, that was really well played. Because they existed in a world that I really didn't know, but I respected them very much, you know, but I didn't feel like I was part of that world. So to get, you know, kind of appreciation from them was really special. It was nice, you know. That was probably one of my more, you know, special musical experiences. Wasn't a great guitar solo, but it's good musical experience.
Yeah.
So
the guitar that you do play every day,
yes.
What is it? Why is it the one?
Well, it's okay. So it's a Gibson 335.
Right.
And it's the one because...
Are these made in Tennessee?
This one was made in Nashville, the one I've got. Some of them are made in Tennessee. Right. The one I have was made from the custom shop in Nashville. Right. And I received it as payment for a gig that I did for Gibson. So quick story. So basically, actually, you know what? I have all these guitars. I've barely bought any of them.
Yeah.
Funny enough. So this one, I did a gig for Gibson for Virgin Airlines.
Yeah.
So Virgin Airlines opened a route from London to, I think, Namibia or somewhere at the time. And they contacted Gibson and said, oh, we would like to, if you get a musician to play at the opening ceremony.
Yeah.
So Juliet Avery, who works at the Gibson Artist Relations, she called me up and said, oh, look, they're doing this flight out to South Africa, you know, Southern Africa. Do you want to play this gig? I was like, yeah, sure. They were like, how much do you want? I was like, can they get me a guitar?
Yeah.
And she was like, yeah, it's, you know, I was like, and she said, yeah, we'll just give you a guitar and we'll just bill them. I was like, cool. She said, do you know what you want? I was like, can I have a couple of days to think about it? She was like, yeah, sure, no problem. So I went on the Gibson website and I looked through everything. I couldn't decide. So I rang her, I said, I can't decide. She's like, well, they've just started doing this reissue of the .335, but with a finish that is a new finish, tri-burst. It's color thing. Yeah. For those who are not guitar aficionados. And she was like, maybe you might be interested in that. I was like, yeah, why not? And I said, she said it'll take 2 weeks to get to you because they got to make it.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, why not? Cool. So I did that. And then 2 weeks later, I got a phone call. Your guitar's here. Got on the tube. Stupid fast. I was in, where were they at the time? They were in Soho at the time. Denmark Street, where all the guitar shops are.
Yeah.
Went there, saw the guitar, it was beautiful, sounded amazing, fell in love with it, played it every day since, you know. Yeah, it's that one because, I don't know, it was kind of made and I'm the only person to have played it.
Yeah,
it's my guitar, you know, even though it's a Gibson.
Yeah.
It's my Gibson.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I guess it's that one.
It's nice because it's hard to get, like, a handmade saxophone would be very, like...
Yeah,
you
know, but then...
culture, you don't really get.
Yeah, but saxophones, don't you want them to be, like, as old as possible?
Yeah, I was going to say that
right.
as well when you were saying about, like, what makes a good guitar. What yeah. makes a good sax is just how old it is.
Yeah.
Like, I love how simple that is.
Yeah.
For the most part,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, I mean, it's... Because, I mean, I don't know why. Is it because of the metals or the way it was made back then? What is
it? The understanding I have of it is that back, like, especially after the Second World War,
mm-hmm.
like, Selma are making saxes with hardly any money, so they're just melting down whatever they can find, you know, and building instruments out of it. And so...
Nice.
So they've got loads of individual character in those horns. And sure, that means you can get some real stinkers.
So technically, yeah. some of that stuff's not brass.
It's finished with brass, but I wouldn't know what was in the exactly the like lower layers of the metal.
Interesting.
Yeah. yeah. And then, wow. of course, as they age, I think that character just magnifies
right.
loads. I mean, the oldest one I've got is the 1958, which Oof. Is kind of like the, you know, that's a good year for jazz. If
right.
you, like,
yeah.
Google your history.
That's,
you know?
That's true.
So,
but how is that? Because... I mean, the good year for jazz is kind of blue year. That's 59, right?
Yeah.
So how's 58 a good year for jazz?
Because... because that's when my sax was made.
Oh, right, I see. Right. I see. For that. Okay, good. Yeah,
I've
yeah.
I've really done a lot of homework about that tenor.
Trust me, my jazz history sucks.
Yeah.
Like, my jazz history... Yeah, sucks.
Yeah.
Quite a lot.
Mine too. Mine
yeah.
Like, other than like the Michael Brecker, Chris Potter kind of timeline, I'm really in quite a lot of trouble. But
you probably shouldn't say that on the podcast.
No, it's terrible.
You've probably got a lot of people like shouting at the...
I'll only get Alan Shipton on because he's a jazz historian.
Ah, there you go.
And then he can really...
He'll school you. Yeah.
In a big way.
Or just really embarrass you.
That's like, fine too. I deserve it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a flagellated
yeah.
for good reason.
Yeah. Yeah, very good reason indeed.
It's funny, the word flagellated sounds too near to flatulence.
Yeah.
It's
too much of a funny word to be used.
Yeah, all right, let's leave that alone, shall we? Okay, so where were we? We were talking about
your
my guitar. Yeah, so guitars us. Also, but the great thing about guitars also is that they also sound better with age.
Really?
Yes.
That's cool.
Because, of course, the wood settles,
yeah.
kind of like a good curry set. Tastes better with age.
Yeah.
Not too much age
not
though.
In the fridge.
That could have been the thing with the curry that I first had.
Yeah.
It could have been that it was too old. Yeah, it wasn't like, you know, vintage curry.
Yeah.
It's probably not
yeah.
as good as vintage guitar, vintage
saxophone. <curry.
laughs> Ooh.
Bad times.
Now that would be flagellation and flatulence of sorts, wouldn't it?
I'd like to think that would cause an internal explosion.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Probably not a good image, actually, right now. Yeah. But yeah, so guitars sound better with age.
Yeah.
In the same way, I guess, saxophones, because the wood settles and becomes more and more resonant.
Yeah.
So they can be good.
Yeah.
Mind you, there was one guitar that I played once. It was a nylon strung classical guitar.
Yeah.
Which I found, well, I didn't find it. I was in a shop in the West End once, and this guy who usually makes violins, he told me a story about how him and his mate broke into someone's garden one year
yeah.
in the early 70s. And this person had chopped down a tree, and they saw he had cut the tree and the wood was all there, and they stole a batch of it. Stole. Yeah,
yeah,
that's what the word he used. He said they stole a batch. They made off of it, and he kept it, the wood, stored, up until, I think, 2009, where he built this guitar. And I played the guitar, and it was the most amazing thing I ever heard, like, as far as nylon strung guitars
yeah.
went. I recorded it on my second album, actually,
okay.
On a couple of tracks, but I couldn't afford it. And I borrowed it. I borrowed it from him for a couple of weeks, recorded the album, well, some of the tracks on the album, gave it back, said, and asked him if I could pay in installments.
Yeah.
He said he would think about it. I said, all right, I'll call you in a few days. Or I came back a few days later, and some Japanese businessman had bought it.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
never least mind. It's on the album.
Exactly.
Which, incidentally, is on your website.
Yes. So which you could, people can, yeah.
That can, is it, it's femitomorrow.com.
Femiguitar.com.
Femiguitar.com. If I write your name into Google, your website comes straight up. So,
which is good.
Yeah.
Which is what you want.
You do want that. You're easily found. And
then my Google Analytics is working as it should. I know nothing about what that means, but
it's doing its job.
I know that it's kind of Is that what they call it? Analytics? Or anyway, search engine things.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
It's working.
So you can go on those. Femi's website and check those two.
Yes, femiguitar.com.
Yeah. And there's three albums on there.
There's three albums on there. The first one, you can just basically have the whole lot.
Yeah.
As you like. Second one, there's quite a lot of free tracks.
Cool.
And the third one, because it's so new, you kind of just have to pay for it.
You've got to find that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But maybe in a few years, I'll give that one away as well.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. But so, it's all on there.
Yeah, that's cool. That's great. Obviously, it's great that people can go listen to it straight away. I'm very kind of you to put some of the stuff up there free, of course.
Yeah, why not? I mean, you know, everyone else is doing it.
Yeah, that's true. So
you don't want to get left behind, you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
God forbid you should charge people for something you've put, you know, blood, sweat and tears into. Yeah. Literally, well, not quite literally, but yeah. But yeah, no, I think nowadays it's absolutely fine. I think it's good to share music. But I think it's also good for people to realize that it doesn't just magically appear from nowhere, you know.
Yeah.
It's livelihood at the end of the day.
Totally. So here's one more question for you.
Yes.
If you could form your own, like, dream rhythm section.
Hello.
Yeah. Actually, there's another question after this.
Oh, okay.
So a dream rhythm section.
Dream rhythm section.
You can I don't mind. Like,
do they have to be living?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
No.
They could be like ghosts, like jamming.
Yeah, like a ghost jam, or like some kind of DNA
ghost jam
creation.
Right, wow.
Yeah.
There's a good sci-fi jazz movie in there somewhere.
There is. Ghost
jam. Ghost jam. That could be cool. Okay, so I would say, so rhythm section, so basically bass and drums.
Yeah.
Okay.
And maybe a piano.
Maybe a pianist.
You're tired.
If I want to coast for a while. Let's see. On drums, Brian Blade would be the drummer for sure. And the bass player would probably be... It would either be Christian McBride.
Yeah.
Or Johnny Patitucci. John Patitucci. Just because for me... Like, the range of music that they cover is so wide.
Yeah.
And that's what... And it's the same in the drums.
Yeah.
It's about the breadth of music that they cover, not just about how well they play any one particular thing. It's about just... They can go anywhere, I feel, musically.
Yeah.
Nice. Those would be my rhythm section choices.
That's great.
And if I had to choose a piano player, it would most likely be... either Herbie Hancock.
Yeah.
Or a very young McCoy Tyner. Because... If you ever heard that album Trio, Super Trio, where McCoy Tyner plays with two trios, so he has, he does like half the album with Ron Carter, and I forget the name of the drummer on that side, and the other half is with Dijonette, with Ron Carter and Dijonette, I think, and the other side is with Miles's later drummer from the... that alarm is for my sourdough bread, which I'm making currently.
Where is it?
It's at home.
In the fridge?
No, it's out in the room temperature right now. It's doing the thing where the sugars are eating the flour.
Yeah.
I forget what the official word for that. Yeah.
Oh, there is basically, a word for that, isn't there?
Like,
Fermentation. Classic.
No, this is not fermentation. This is Oh, I forget. It doesn't matter.
Sounds spectacular.
It is really
sugar. The other thing that you said. Yeah.
Yeah, it's
the one where the sugar does.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The sugar is eating the flour, or is it the other way around? The flour's eating the sugar. Anyway, someone's eating someone something. Yeah, and it's something good for bread. for really good tasty bread, yeah. So that was that alarm. Anyway, so it was Tony Williams.
Right.
And I can't remember who the bass player was, but yeah, it's Trooper Trios.
Yeah.
And on this album, McCoy Tyner is absolutely burning. Like, every track is burning. So yeah, McCoy Tyner would be a piano player.
Beautiful. I bet 58 is a good year for McCoy Tyner.
Yes,
got a good feeling about it.
Yeah, not sure what he did, but let's just assume it was.
Yeah, and if you could only ever listen to one album again, call it Death Row CD.
Oh my gosh!
So you've got one last CD.
Yes.
Instead of a meal.
Yeah.
What would you go for?
Wow. I would probably say, and I bet you've probably heard other people say this, if it a jazz record or just any record?
Absolutely anything.
Oh, wow. Oh, man, that makes it even harder.
Yeah.
Whew. Absolutely any record.
Mm-hmm.
I'm tempted to say, and a lot of people would be like, really? Why? An album called Travelogue by Joni Mitchell.
Lovely. Classy choice.
Yeah.
People are going to just come because, on Twitter.
Yeah, right. Like, what? Just because it, you know, it's got Brian Blade on there.
Yeah.
It's got Herbie on there. It's got Wayne Shorter on there.
Yeah.
It's got the incredible orchestrations of, again, the name just completely skipped out of my head. I'll come back to that. And it's Joni's voice.
Yeah. What year would this have been?
30 years later. I think the early 2000s. I think Travelogue came out in 2001.
Mendoza.
There we go. Thank you. He did all the orchestrations for that. I think they did Travelogue and then they did Both Sides Now. Yeah. You know, they were kind of reimagined things after that because that went so well.
Yeah.
But it would be that record, I think, because it features some of my favorite songs of hers and a few others that she had never recorded before.
Yeah.
And I can listen to it over and over again because it's an orchestral work. Every time I go back to it, there's something that I hear that I just didn't hear the last time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That would be my choice.
Beautiful.
Mm.
Femi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been awesome.
So next week's show, don't really talk about next week's show, but
we should probably talk about next week's show.
Next week is Trish Clues.
Is it going to be Trish?
It's going to be Trish.
Great, okay, that'll be nice.
Too many dudes, so I thought
we do need to mix it up, don't we?
Well, there's a lot of female guests coming up anyway, but
well, yeah, we've got Nikki and Lauren and Laura.
Yeah, that's a big hitting trio coming up. But yeah, as Trish's is done, she's going to dive in. If Kit, if you're listening, James Madron, if you're listening, I apologise. Trish is absolutely jumping the queue and you know it.
And that's next Friday.
Yeah, awesome. The Jazz Podcast. You can find us every Friday on iTunes, on Stitcher, not on YouTube because that would be weird.
Yeah, that would be a bit weird. Who listens to podcasts on YouTube?
I don't know if anyone does that unless it's a video podcast, which it isn't because we don't have a makeup department or anything like that.
Yeah.
Or any camera equipment or any video editing software. But other than those reasons, that obviously then maybe one day we'll expand.
Yeah, that would be good. I was speaking to a guy this week about doing, he recommends that we do a Facebook Live one time.
That sounds cool. I reckon during the London Jazz Festival we should go for it.
Oh yeah, that would be good, wouldn't it?
Let's do it.
I'd enjoy that. Right. I've got to go. It's dinner time. Have we had any more listeners since we've started doing this?
Well, I'm in blackout till I watch the Super Bowl, so I can't.
Oh, you can't go online?
Can't go online. I can't do anything.
We've had over 300 downloads, Rob.
Oh, sweet. That's awesome. Well, thank you, people.
And we had some really nice messages as well, didn't we?
Some wonderful messages, particularly with regards to Loz's show.
Yep.
And
no, people didn't really care about Stan, did they?
Not so much, no.
Maybe we should probably edit that bit out.
Come on, people, listen to Stan's show.
I'm going to Google who wins the Super Bowl. Super Bowl, hold on.
Oh, no, I've got to go. I've got to go.
No, I'm going to Google it. Hold on.
No, don't tell me, though.
Oh,
no. Oh, no.
Oh.